Swiftly, Craig checked the curved banana magazine and then reloaded the chamber. The weapon was new and well cared for. The weight of it in Craig's hands changed his whole personality. Minutes before, he had been mere flotsam on the stream, swept along by events over which he had no control, confused and uncertain and afraid. But now he was armed. Now he could fight back. Now he could protect his woman and himself. Now he could shape events rather than be shaped by them. It was the primeval, atavistic instinct of primitive man, and Craig revelled in it. He reached over the seat and took Sally Ann's hand. He squeezed it briefly, and fervently she returned the pressure. "Now we have a fighting chance at least," the new tone of his voice reached her. Her spirits lifted a little, and she gave him the first smile he had seen that night. He freed his hand, found the bottle of cane spirit in the cubbyhole, and passed it to her. After she had drunk, he gave it to Timon and Bebe. "All right, Captain, now what the hell is going on here?" Timon gasped at the sting of the liquor, and his voice was roughened by it as he replied. "You are perfectly correct, Mr. Mello. My orders from General Funkebera were to take you and Miss J into the bush and execute you. And you are also correct in guessing that your disappearance would be blamed on the Matabili dissidents." "Well, why didn't you obey your orders?" Before replying, Timon handed the bottle back to Craig and then glanced over his shoulder at Sally Ann. "I am sorry that I had to go through the preparations for your execution without being able to reassure you, but my men speak English. I had to make it look real. It galled me, for I didn't want to inflict more on you after what you had already suffered." "Captain Mbebe, I forgive you everything, and I love you for what you're doing, but why in God's name are you doing it?" Sally Ann demanded. "What I am about to tell you, I have never told a living soul before. You see, my mother was a full-blooded Matabili. She died when I was very young, but I remember her well and honour that memory." He did not look at them, but concentrated on the track ahead. "I was raised as a Shona by my father, but I have always been aware of my Matabili blood. They are my people, and I can no longer stomach what is being done to them. I am certain that General Funkebera has become aware of my feelings, though I doubt that he knows about my mother. But he knows that I have reached the end of my usefulness to him. Recently there have been small signs of it. I have lived too close to the man-eating leopard for too long not to know its moods. After I had buried you, there would have been something for me also, an unmarked grave, or Fungabera's puppies." Timon used the Sindebele. "Amawundla ka Fungabera." And Craig was startled. Sarah Nyoni, the schoolteacher at Tuti Mission, had used the same phrase. "I've heard that expression before. I do not understand it." "Hyena," Timon explained. "Those who die or are executed at the rehabilitation centres are taken into the bush and laid out for the hyena. The hyena leaves nothing, not a chip of bone nor a tuft of hair." "Oh, God," said Sally Ann in a small voice. "We were at Turi. We heard the brutes, but didn't understand. How many have gone that way?" Timon and Bebe said, "I can only guess. Many thousands." "It's scarcely believable." "General Fungabera's hatred for the Matabili is a kind of madness, an obsession. He is planning to wipe them out. First it was their leaders, accused of treason, falsely accused, like Tungata Zibiwe." "Oh no," Sally Ann said miserably. "I can't bear it." "Was Zibiwe innocent?" "I am sorry, Miss J," Timon and Bebe confirmed it. "Fungabera had to be very careful when he tackled Zibiwe. He knew if he seized him for his political activities, he would have the entire Matabili tribe in revolt. You and Mr. Mello provided him with the perfect opportunity. A non-political crime. A crime of greed." "I am being stupid," said Sally Ann. "If Zibiwe wasn't the master poacher, was there ever a poacher? And if there was, who was it?" "General Fungabera himself," said Timon and Bebe simply. "Are you sure?" Craig was incredulous. "I was personally in charge of many of the shipments of animal contraband that left the country. But that night on the Karoi Road..." "That was easily arranged. The general knew that sooner or later Zibiwe would be going to Tuti Mission again. Zibiwe's secretary informed us of the exact time and date. We arranged for their truck loaded with contraband driven by a Matabele detainee we had bribed to be waiting for him on the Tutti Road. Of course, we had not anticipated Tungata Zebiwe's violent reaction. That was merely a bonus for us. Timon drove as fast as the track would allow, while Sally Ann and Craig hunched down in their seats, their artificial elation at their escape rapidly giving way to fatigue and shock. "Where are you heading?" Craig asked. "Botswana border." That was the landlocked state to the south and west, which had become an established staging post for political fugitives from its neighbours. "On our way, I hope you will have a chance to see what is really happening to my people. No one else will bear witness. General Fungubera has sealed off the whole of southwestern Matabele land. No journalists are allowed in, no clergymen, no Red Cross." He slowed for an area where ant bears had dug their holes in the track, burrowing for the nests of termites, and then he accelerated again. "The pass I have from General Fungubera will take us a little further, but not as far as the border. We will have to use side roads and back roads until we can find a crossing place. Very soon General Fungubera will learn of my defection, and we will be hunted by the whole of the 3rd Brigade. We must make as much distance as we can before that happens." They reached the main fork in the track, and Timon stopped, but kept the motor running. He took a large-scale map from his leather map case and studied it attentively. "We are just south of the railway line. This is the road to Empandini Mission Station. If we can get through there before the alarm goes out for us, then we can try for their border between Madaba and Matsumi. The Botswana police run a regular patrol along the fence." "Well, let's get on with it." Craig was impatient and becoming fearful, the comfort of the weapon across his lap beginning to fade. Timon folded the map and drove on. "Can I ask you some more questions?" Sally Ann spoke after a few minutes. "I will try to answer," Timon agreed. "The murder of the Goodwins and the other white families in Matabele land, were those atrocities ordered by Tungata Zebiwe? Is he responsible for those gruesome murders?" "No, no, Miss J. Zebiwe has been trying desperately to control those killers. I believe that he was on his way to Tutti Mission for just such a reason, to meet with the radical Matabele elements and try to reason with them." "But the writing in blood, Tungata Zebiwe lives." Now Timon Mbebe was silent, his face contorted as though he fought some inner battle, and they waited for him to speak. At last he sighed explosively, and his voice had changed. "Miss J, please try to understand my position. Before you judge me for what I am about to tell you, General Fungubera is a persuasive man. I was carried along by his promises of glory and reward. Then suddenly I had gone too far and I was not able to turn back. I think the English expression is riding the tiger. I was forced to move on from one bad deed to another even worse." He paused, and then in a rush. "Miss J, I personally recruited the killers of the Goodwin family from the rehabilitation center. I told them where to go, what to do, and what to write on the wall. I supplied their weapons and arranged for them to be driven to the area in transport of the 3rd Brigade." There was silence again, broken only by the throb of the Land Rover engine. And Timon Mbebe had to break it, speaking as though words were an opiate for his guilt. "They were Matabele, veterans, war-hard men, men who would do anything for the return of their personal liberty, the chance to carry weapons again. They did not hesitate." "And Fungubera ordered it?" Craig said. "Of course. It was his excuse to begin the purge of the Matabele. Now perhaps you understand why I am fleeing with you. I could not continue along this path. The other murders, the killing of Senator Savage and his family?" Sally Ann asked. "General Fungubera did not have to order those." Timon shook his head. "Those were copycat murders. The bush is still full of wild men from the war. They hide their weapons and come into the towns. Some even have regular jobs, but at the weekend or on public holiday, they return to the bush, dig up their rifles and go on the rampage. They are not political dissidents. They are armed bandits, and the white families are the juiciest, softest targets, rich and helpless, deprived of their weapons by Mugabe's government, so they cannot defend themselves."
and it all plays right into Peter Fungerbearer's hands. Any bandit is labelled a political dissident, any grisly robbery an excuse to continue the purge, held up to the world as proof of the savagery and intractability of the Matabele tribe. Craig continued for him. That is correct, Mr. Mellor. And he has already murdered Tungata Sabiwe. Craig felt old and tired, with regret and guilt for his old comrade. You can be sure of that. No, Mr. Mellor. Timon shook his head. I do not believe that Sibiwe is dead. I believe General Fungerbearer wants him alive. He has some plans for him.
What plans? Craig demanded.
I do not know for certain, but I believe Peter Fungerbearer is dealing with the Russians.
The Russians? Craig looked his disbelief.
He has had secret meetings with a stranger, a foreigner, a man who I believe is an important member of Russian intelligence.
Are you sure, Timon?
I have seen the man with my own eyes.
Craig thought about that for a few seconds and then reverted to his original question.
Okay, leave the Russians for the moment. Where is Tungata Sabiwe? Where is Fungerbearer holding him?
Again, I do not know. I'm sorry, Mr. Mellor.
If he is alive, then may the Lord have mercy on his soul, Craig whispered.
He could imagine what Tungata must be suffering. He was silent for a few minutes, and then he changed the line of questioning.
General Fungerbearer has seized my property for himself, not for the state. I am correct in believing that.
The general wanted that land very badly. He spoke of it often.
How?
I mean, even quasi-legally. How will he work it?
It is very simple, Timon explained. You are an admitted enemy of the state. Your property is forfeited. It will be confiscated to the state. The land bank will repudiate the suretyship for your loan under the release clause which you signed. The custodian of enemy property will put up your shares of Roland's company for sale by private tender. General Fungerbearer's tender will be accepted. His brother-in-law is custodian of enemy property. The tender price will be greatly advantageous to the general.
I bet, said Craig bitterly.
But why should he go to such lengths? Sally Ann demanded. He must be a millionaire many times over. Surely he's got enough already.
Miss J, for some men, there is no such thing as enough.
He cannot hope to get away with it, though, surely.
Who is there to prevent him doing so, Miss J?
And when she did not reply, Timon went on.
Africa is going back to where it was before the white man intruded. There's only one criterion for a ruler here, and that is strength. We Africans do not trust anything else. Fungerbearer is strong, as Tungata Sabiwe was once strong.
Timon glanced at his wristwatch. But we must eat. I think we will all have a long day ahead of us. He pulled off the track and drove the Land Rover into a patch of second-growth scrub. He climbed onto the bonnet and arranged branches to cover the vehicle, hiding it from detection from the air, and then opened the case of emergency rations from the locker under the passenger seat. There was water in the tank under the floorboards. Craig filled a metal canteen with sand and soaked the sand with gasoline from the reserve tank. It made a smokeless burner on which to brew tea. They ate the unappetizing cold rations with little conversation. Once Timon turned up the volume on the radio to listen to a transmission, then shook his head.
Nothing to do with us.
He came back to squat beside Craig.
How far to the border do you reckon? Craig asked with a mouthful of cold, sticky bully beef.
40 miles or a little more.
The radio crackled to life again, and Timon jumped up and stooped over it attentively.
There is a unit of the 3rd Brigade just a few miles ahead of us, he reported. They are at the mission station at Empandini. There has been action against dissidents, but they had dealt with them and they are moving out.
Perhaps this way. We must be careful.
I will check that we are hidden from the road, Craig stood up. Sally Ann, douse the fire. Captain, cover me. He picked up the AK-47 and ran back to the track. Critically, he examined the patch of scrub that concealed the Land Rover, and then brushed over his own tracks and those of the vehicle with a leafy twig, and carefully straightened the grass that the Land Rover had flattened where it left the road. It wasn't perfect, but it would bear a cursory examination from a speeding vehicle, he thought. And then there was the faint vibration on the windless air. He listened. The sound of truck motors strengthening. Craig ran back to the Land Rover and climbed into the front seat beside Timon.
"Put your rifle back in the rack," Timon said. And when Craig hesitated, "Please do as I say, Mr. Mello. If they find us, it will be useless to fight. I will have to try and talk our way through. I couldn't explain if you were armed."
Reluctantly, Craig passed the weapon back to Sally Ann. She racked it, and Craig was left feeling naked and vulnerable. He clenched his fists in his lap. The sound of motors grew swiftly, and then over them the voices of men singing. The song grew louder, and despite his tension, Craig felt the hair prickle on the nape of his neck to the peculiar beauty of African voices raised in song.
"Third Brigade," Timon said. "That is the song of the rain winds, the praise song of the regiment."
Neither of them replied, and Timon hummed the tune to himself and then began to sing softly. He had a startlingly true and thrilling voice. "When the nation burns, the rain winds bring relief. When the cattle are drought-stricken, the rain winds lift them up. When your children cry with thirst, the rain winds slake them. We are the winds that bring the rain. We are the good winds of the nation." Timon translated from the Shona for their benefit, and now Craig could see the grey dust of the trucks smoking up above the scrub, and the singing was close and clear. There was a flash of reflected sunlight off metal, and then through the foliage Craig caught quick glimpses of the passing convoy. There were three trucks, painted a dull sand colour, and the backs were crowded with soldiers in battle camouflage and bush hats, their weapons held ready at the high port position. On the cab of the last truck rode an officer, the only one of them wearing the red beret and silver cap badge. He looked directly at Craig and seemed very close, the screen of foliage suddenly very sparse. Craig shrank down in his seat. Then, thankfully, the convoy was past, the rumble of engines and the singing dwindling, the pale dust settling. Timon Imbebe exhaled a long breath. "There will be others," he cautioned, and with his fingers on the ignition key waited until the silence was complete once again. Then he started the Land Rover, reversed out of the scrub, and turned back onto the track. He swung the Land Rover in the opposite direction from the convoy, and they drove over the rugged tracks that the trucks had imprinted deeply into the sandy earth. They drove for another 20 minutes before Timon ducked down abruptly in his seat to peer up at the sky through the windshield.
"Smoke," he said. "Mpandini is just ahead. Will you have your camera ready, Miss J? I believe the 3rd Brigade will have left something for you."
They came to the maize fields that surrounded the mission village. The maize stalks had dried. The cobs in their yellow sheaths were beginning to droop heavily, ready for the harvest. There had been women working in the fields. One of them lay beside the track. She had been shot in the back as she ran. The bullet had exited between her breasts. The unweaned child that she carried on her back had been bayoneted many times. The flies rose up in a blue hum as they passed, and then settled again. Nobody spoke. Sally Ann reached into her camera bag and brought out her Nikon. She was bloodless grey under her freckles. The other women lay further from the road, mere bundles of gay cloth, heavily stained. There were possibly 50 huts in the village. All of them were burning, the thatch roofs torching up to the clear blue morning sky. They had thrown most of the corpses into the burning huts, leaving black puddles drying where they had fallen and drag marks in the dust. The smell of seared flesh was very strong. It coated the roofs of their mouths like congealed pork fat. Craig's stomach heaved, and he covered his mouth and nose with his hand.
"These are dissidents," Sally Ann whispered. Her lips were icy white.
The motor drive of her Nikon whirred as she shot through the open window. They had killed the chickens. The loose feathers rolled on the light breeze, like the stuffing from a burst pillow.
"Stop," Sally Ann ordered. "It is dangerous to stay," said Timon. "Stop," Sally Ann repeated.
She left the door open and went among the huts. working swiftly, changing roll after roll of film with practiced nimble fingers, while her white lips trembled and her eyes behind the lens were huge with horror. "We must move on," said Timon. "Wait." Sally Ann moved quickly forward, doing her job like the professional she was. She moved behind a group of huts. The smell of burning flesh nauseated Craig, and the heat from the fires came at him in great furnace gusts as the breeze veered. Sally Ann screamed, and the two men jumped from the Land Rover and ran cocking their rifles, diverging to give each other covering fire. Craig, finding his old training, returning instinctively. He came around the side of a hut. Sally Ann stood in the open, no longer able to use her camera. A naked black woman lay at her feet. The woman's upper body was that of a comely, healthy young woman. Below her navel, she was pink, skinless monstrosity. She had dragged herself back out of the fire into which they had thrown her. There were places on her lower body where the burning was not deep. Here the flesh was piebald pink and weeping lymph. Then in other places the bone was exposed. Her hip bone, charred black as charcoal, protruded obscenely from the scorched meat of her pelvic area. The lining of her stomach had burned through, and her entrails bulged from the opening. Miraculously, she was still alive. Her fingers raked the dust with a repetitive mechanical movement. Her mouth opened and closed convulsively, making no sound, and her eyes were wide open, aware and suffering. "Go back to the Land Rover, please, Miss J," Timon Mbebe said. "There is nothing you can do to help her." Sally Ann stood stiffly, unable to move. Craig put his arm around her shoulders and turned her away. He led her back towards the Land Rover. At the corner of the burning hut, Craig glanced back. Timon Mbebe had moved up close to the maimed woman. He stood over her with the AK-47 held ready on his hip. His whole attention was focused upon her, and his face was almost as riven with suffering as was the woman's. Craig took Sally Ann around the hut. Behind them there was the whip crack of a single shot, muted by the crackle of flames all around them. Sally Ann stumbled and then caught her balance. When they reached the Land Rover, Sally Ann leaned against the cab and doubled over slowly. She vomited in the dust, and then straightened up and wiped her mouth with the back of her hand. Craig took the bottle of cane spirit from the cubbyhole. There was an inch of the clear liquor remaining. He gave it to Sally Ann, and she drank it like water. Craig took the empty bottle back from her, and then abruptly and savagely hurled it into the burning hut. Timon Mbebe came around the hut. Wordlessly, he climbed behind the steering wheel, and Craig helped Sally Ann into the rear seat. They drove slowly through the rest of the village, their heads turning from side to side as each fresh horror was revealed. As they passed the little church of red brick, the roof collapsed in upon itself, and the wooden cross on the spire was swallowed in a belch of sparks and flames and blue smoke. In the bright sunlight, the flames were almost colourless.